Welcome to Base by Base. Have you ever imagined a future where medicine isn't just, you know, reacting to illness, but actively preventing it, tailored precisely to you? This whole vision, people often call it precision health, well, it puts genetic insights right at the center. It really hints at a big shift in how we look at our own well-being. Today, we're starting an exploration into a technology that many see as potentially transformative in healthcare, polygenic risk scores, PRSs for short. Think of them maybe as a powerful new lens, a way for doctors to view your unique health landscape. Our mission really in this discussion is to unpack the evidence. What do we know about the costs, the benefits of these PRS-based approaches in actual clinical practice? We'll be digging into a really thorough systematic review to get those insights, hopefully giving you a clear path to understanding what these scores might mean for healthcare's future.
Yeah, and it's a crucial conversation to have right now, especially because the cost of sequencing a genome has just plummeted, hasn't it? We're seeing this, well, explosion of genetic data. But all this data, while exciting, it brings a whole set of new, pretty complex challenges for our healthcare systems. We're talking practical hurdles like, you know, shortages of trained staff, the huge effort needed to build the right IT infrastructure, and we definitely need solid ways to assess these new technologies. And in healthcare systems where, let's face it, resources are already tight, understanding the economic value of complex things like PRSs isn't just nice to know. It's absolutely critical for deciding if and how they can actually be adopted.
Okay, so let's start there, laying the groundwork. What exactly is a polygenic risk score? In simple terms, a PRS is basically a number, right? A score that measures your genetic predisposition, your inherited risk for a particular disease.
That's a good way to think about it. And importantly, these scores aren't based on just one or two genes, not at all. They're calculated by combining the effects of many, sometimes thousands, of independent genetic risk variants. These are tiny differences in our DNA, often called single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs. You can think of SNPs like single-letter typos in our genetic code, tiny changes. And these are found through massive research projects, genome-wide association studies, or GWAS. Scientists scan whole genomes from loads of people to find these subtle variations linked to diseases. So it's really about the cumulative impact of all these small genetic markers working together.
Right, the cumulative effect. And the potential uses seem incredibly broad, spanning like the whole healthcare journey. We hear about PRSs being proposed for, well, stratifying population risks, so sorting people into risk groups for prevention efforts, but also for identifying high-risk patients who might benefit from specific therapies when it comes to treatment. But they're not usually used alone, are they? They're combined with other things.
Exactly. That's key. They're almost always combined with other clinical risk factors, things like your age, your lifestyle, family history, all the usual suspects. It gives a more complete picture of someone's overall risk.
Okay.
And, you know, it's a powerful idea, and PRSs have definitely generated a lot of excitement in the scientific literature. There's loads written about them. However, their actual clinical utility, what they really add in practice, how much they improve patient outcomes or efficiency, that's still, well, it's still being debated quite a bit. Despite all the research, actually proving clear tangible benefits in the real world, that remains a pretty significant challenge.
Which brings us neatly to the main source for our discussion today. It's a systematic review titled Weighing the Evidence on Costs and Benefits of Polygenic Risk-Based Approaches in Clinical Practice, a systematic review of economic evaluations.
That's the one. This comprehensive review was led by Dr. Sienna and her colleagues. It was published in the American Journal of Human Genetics 2025. And their goals were really threefold. First, give an overview of cost-effectiveness across different healthcare contexts. Second, to critically look at the methods used, how researchers actually quantified the costs and the health benefits. And finally, to pull together the main challenges they found and suggest directions for future research.
And it sounds like they were really thorough in how they did it. A systematic search across major databases like PubMed, Web of Science, Scopus, specifically looking for full economic evaluations, right? Studies that looked at both sides, costs and benefits.
Precisely. They focused on studies that quantified both the financial costs and the health outcomes of using PRSs clinically. This usually involves methods like cost-effectiveness analysis, basically asking, are we getting enough health improvement for the money spent? Or even cost-utility analysis, CUA, which factors in the quality of life gain, not just the length. It measures benefits in quality-adjusted life years, or QAOS. and to make sure the studies they included were reliable, they used a standard tool, the Quality of Health Economics Studies, QHES, checklist. Think of it like a quality score for the research. Articles scoring over 75 out of 100 were considered high quality. Now, because the studies were quite different from each other, what we call substantial heterogeneity, looking at different populations, different methods, they couldn't really average the results together in a meta-analysis. But they ended up including 24 cost-utility analyses in their final review. Okay, 24 studies. So where are these economic evaluations mainly focused? What kinds of diseases? You said the split was quite revealing. 16 on cancer, 5 on cardiovascular disease, 3 on others. Cancer seems to be the big one.
It really does dominate the current landscape, yeah. Looking at those cancer studies, most were aimed at optimizing screening programs. So figuring out the best way to screen for prostate, colorectal, breast, lung cancer, even nasopharyngeal carcinoma, or sometimes multiple cancers at once using PRSs. The quality of these analyses was generally seen as robust and high quality. Many scored 90 or above on that QHES checklist, which is excellent.
Okay, so methodologically sound. But what about the results? Were they cost effective? Well, that's where it gets mixed. They found a positive trend toward cost effectiveness, certainly. But some studies concluded, yes, PRSs were cost effective. Others found they weren't, or maybe only for a specific subgroup of people. So not a completely clear picture for cancer screening yet.
Yeah.
There was one interesting study, though, where the PRS wasn't for screening but was employed to guide therapy, specifically for breast cancer chemotherapy decisions. And that study found that using the PRS to inform those decisions was cost-effective. So that's a promising angle beyond just screening.
Interesting. Guiding therapy. Okay, let's shift gears then. What about cardiovascular disease, CVD? You said 5 studies looked at that. Here, it seems the focus was more on prevention, like refine eligibility for preventative therapies.
That's right. Things like deciding who really benefits most from statin therapy for cholesterol, or who needs screening for an abdominal aortic aneurysm in AAA. High-impact preventive stuff.
And how did the economics look here? More consistent?
Much more consistent, actually. The review highlights that the CVD studies generally found that incorporating a PRS into existing screening programs was cost-effective. They showed the greatest consistency, both in the number of studies finding positive results and the similarity, the homogeneity of those findings. So yeah, a clearer signal for PRS utility in CVD prevention.
Okay, that's encouraging for heart health. And then there were those 3 studies on other diseases, type 2 diabetes and glaucoma.
Yes. For type 2 diabetes, both studies included found that using PRSs in prevention programs, one for diabetic kidney disease, the other for T2D itself, was cost effective.
Yeah.
And the single study on primary open angle glaucoma, or POAG, also found PRS screening to be a promising cost-effective intervention.
So positive results there too.
Pretty much. And the important point the review makes is that these studies, the ones on diabetes and glaucoma, they employed real-world cohorts. They used data from actual patient groups, unlike many of the cancer studies, which, as we mentioned, often relied more on theoretical models, hypothetical cohorts. That adds a layer of realism to these findings.
Right. Real-world data versus models. That brings us nicely to the next part. The critical look the review took at the methodologies themselves. Despite the often positive findings and high quality scores, they flagged some few limitations worth discussing, didn't they? Some unexamined realities.
They certainly did. And this is crucial for understanding where we go next.
Mm.
A major issue was that reliance on hypothetical cohorts we just touched on. Most studies use these simulated patient groups. And the problem with that is, well, think about it. Models are simplifications. They tend to homogenize individual variability, smooth out all the complex differences between real people.
So they might not capture the full picture.
Exactly. It limits the generalizability of the findings. The results you get are heavily dependent on the model's assumptions. If the assumptions are off or don't reflect reality well enough, the conclusions might not hold up in the real world. It really highlights why we need more studies using actual patient data, messy as it might be.
Makes sense. Models are only as good as their assumptions. What about the diversity of the people in those models or in the real-world data? How well was that handled?
That was another big gap. Insufficient attention to representativeness. We know that ethnicity and ancestry can significantly influence predisposition to specific conditions. Plus, and this is critical, most available PRSs have the greatest predictive power for individuals of a specific ancestry, usually European ancestry, because that's where most of the big genetic studies have been done.
So the tools themselves might be biased?
Potentially, yes, or at least less accurate for other groups. Yet, the review found these crucial factors were seldom addressed in the economic evaluations. In fact, they state clearly that none of the included studies conducted EEs across different ancestry groups. That's a major blind spot for equity. If the tool doesn't work equally well for everyone, its overall value is questionable, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's a huge issue. Okay, so problems with the models, problems with representation. What about the nuts and bolts of actually using PRSs in clinics? Were those costs looked at?
Generally, no. That was another area flagged: insufficient attention paid to PRS delivery models and other key organizational factors. Things like, what does it actually cost to scale up lab capacity, to train the workforce, doctors, nurses, genetic counselors, to build the IT systems needed to handle all this genetic data? These implementation costs, the review notes, remain largely unexamined. We just don't have a good handle on the true cost of rolling these things out system-wide. It's a big unknown in the economic equation.
Like planning a party, but forgetting to budget for the venue or the catering?
Something like that, yeah. And then there's the question of the benefits measured. Did they capture everything?
What do you mean? What might they have missed?
Well, the review points out a limited scope of health benefits. The studies focused almost exclusively on the direct clinical stuff, avoiding the disease, living longer, the standard health outcomes. But they tended to neglect the unique considerations associated with genetic testing itself. Things like the implications of cascade testing. You test one person, find something, and then maybe their siblings, parents, kids need testing too. That has costs and benefits. Or the return of secondary or incidental findings. You test for breast cancer risk, but the test also flags a high risk for Alzheimer's. How do you factor that in? And crucially, the studies mostly ignored the broader health effects associated with knowing one's own PRS. Things like the anxiety a high-risk result can cause, or maybe false reassurance from a low score, or how people might change their behavior for better or worse based on that information.
Right. The psychological and social side of things, that's huge with genetic info.
It really is. And it often gets left out of these purely clinical economic models.
You also mentioned something called Rose's prevention paradox being relevant here. What's that about?
Yes. Rose's paradox. It basically points out that even with a good prevention strategy, like PRS-based screening, you'll find that a significant number of incident cases will always be excluded.
Mm-hmm.
These are people classified as low risk by the PRS, so they aren't targeted by the screening or prevention program.
Yeah.
Yet because there are so many more people in the low-risk group than the high-risk group, these low-risk individuals collectively will account for the majority of cases of the disease in the population overall.
So you target the high-risk few, but most cases still come from the low-risk many.
Exactly. It's a paradox. It doesn't mean the PRS isn't useful for the high-risk group, but it highlights that even perfect risk stratification won't eliminate the disease entirely at a population level. There are limits.
Okay, that's a sobering thought. And what about the PRS predictions themselves? How solid are they?
Well, there are inherent predictive limitations.
Hmm.
We have to remember that for common, complex diseases, PRSs inherently explain only a fraction of disease risk. These conditions result from a complex interplay of numerous genetic and environmental factors. Genes are only part of the story. Plus, there's this issue of rank instability. How a PRS is built, the specific SNPs included, the statistical methods can vary. And this means that individual PRS rankings can vary considerably depending on the construction methods used. Someone might rank as high risk using one score calculation, but only moderate risk using another. That raises questions about consistency.
Mm-hmm. Instability. And one last economic point. What about costs beyond direct healthcare spending?
Yes. The review highlighted that indirect costs were mostly ignored. These are things like lost work productivity, the cost of informal caregiving, the broader societal impact of the illness. These are vital for a comprehensive assessment of the socioeconomic impact of any new health technology, but they were largely missing from these PRS evaluations. So we're likely underestimating the full economic picture.
Okay, so putting all this together, the promising findings, but also these significant limitations and gaps. What's the bottom line? What did the review conclude about the future here?
The main takeaway is that while there's definitely a positive trend, especially for CVD, significant challenges remain. That's mm-hmm. pretty clear. It really emphasizes the need for pilot studies and further research studies grounded in the real world, capturing the true costs and benefits across diverse groups.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe most importantly, we need actual clinical trials incorporating PRSs into clinical practice. We have to validate these tools in real-world settings to see if they genuinely improve outcomes for patients. The modeling is useful, but it's not enough.
And did the review suggest specific directions for that future research? Where should efforts be focused?
Yes. It laid out several key areas. One is evaluating PRS applications across diverse populations for multiple health outcomes simultaneously, moving beyond single diseases and single groups. Another is working to enhance PRS discrimination power. That means finding new predictive SNPs, combining PRSs better with other risk factors, and crucially, incorporating diverse ethnicities into the development process to make them more equitable.
Right, improving the tools themselves.
Exactly. And also focusing squarely on whether these PRS strategies can meaningfully contribute to clinical public health decision making. Do they actually change management in a beneficial way? And finally, a strong push to collect data on long-term outcomes, not just immediate effects. And to consider using a broader impact inventory in economic studies, capturing those wider benefits and costs, including the psychosocial ones and indirect costs we talked about.
Okay. So if we were to summarize the core message from this systematic review, polygenic risk scores definitely hold a lot of promise for precision health. Initial economic studies show a positive trend, maybe most clearly for cardiovascular disease.
Absolutely. But, and it's a big but, the nuanced reality is that their true value, their widespread equitable application, their smooth integration into healthcare, that's still very much a work in progress. Getting there will require much more and much better real-world evidence, and we absolutely have to pay closer attention to those often overlooked factors like equity, implementation costs, and the full spectrum of benefits and harms.
It leaves us with a pretty big question, doesn't it? As genetic testing gets more common, how do we as individuals, as a society, make sure these incredibly powerful tools are not just scientifically sound, but also economically viable and, crucially, fairly accessible to everyone, no matter their background or where they happen to live? What does all this make you think about your own health data?
This episode is based on an open access article under the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License, CC BY 4.0. You'll find the DOI and a link to the license in the episode description.